This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battling a gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history and its memorabilia on the Sports History Network in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. And I'd like to tell my guests and my audience tonight, our co-host Joe Squires is on holiday at the World Cup in Mexico City, believe it or not. And our show today will feature a special guest who's well-known to both our magazine and to our podcast. Our special guest was born and raised in Pittsburgh and now resides in Jacksonville, Florida. You can listen to his Total Sports Recall podcast, and which is also available on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Music. He currently writes for AbstractSports.com. the Sports History Network, and he's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine. He wrote the published book, Pro Football's Most Passionate Fans, and as a professional writer, has had articles published in an array of sports publications. He loves all sports, but football and baseball are at the top of his interests. His passion is for sports history. Visit his portfolio at clippingsme.totalsportsrecall. You can contact him using his official podcast email address, which is totalsportsrecall@gmail.com. And you can also reach out to him on X at using his handle at totalsportsrecall. Leave a voice message for the Total Sports Recast podcast to be aired at a later date. And I'd like to welcome to our show Mr. Harv Aronson. Harv, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Bob, and thanks for having me on your show again.
Thanks for being on, and thanks for coming back on. And we were chatting a bit before the show. It's been over 12 years now that we've had a working relationship between Gridiron Greats Magazine, your books, your writings, so on and so forth. I don't know where the time goes. It's just truly amazing to me.
I'm telling you, I actually think it goes back to 2009. I have all your magazines and all the ones I've written for you. And I think 2009 was actually the first story I wrote for you. So, gosh.
Right.
17 years ago.
I forgot about that.
And, yeah.
We had just taken over the magazine in 2008, so you pretty much have been there.
Wow.
Wow.
That I didn't realize. So yeah. That's incredible.
Long, long time. Long, long haul, to say the least.
But yeah. Time flies.
You've been on our podcast several times in the past, so for those who have not heard those podcasts in previous years, can you just give us a little background on how you got interested in football and the history of the game?
Well, I mean, growing up in Pittsburgh, and I really pretty much started watching football in 1972, obviously with the Franco Harris's Immaculate Reception is what turned my interest to football. And just started liking the sport. And once I got to high school, I started writing for the school newspaper, and just always been interested in sports from that in football anyway, Immaculate Reception. But a year before that, the Pirates had won the World Series, and that was my first real true sports memory. Seeing Roberto Clemente hit a home run in the seventh game of the World Series, and that got my interest in sports. And so since 12 years old, I've been watching and writing and doing sports writing. And eventually, I got around to I had wanted to be a sports broadcaster. That never really panned out, but the podcast, the idea was provided by my wife, actually, is she told me I should do a podcast. Started doing it, and it's just my a kind of way to get what I was really after when I came out of college, which was announcing.
Sounds great. And I remember you were talking about the Pirates back in 72, and your Pittsburgh teams were very, very good in the 70s. You had a nice run with the Steelers, and you had the Pirates at the same time. That could attract anyone's interest with regards to becoming a fan of the teams and writing about them, so on and so forth. So that's neat. That's really cool.
Well, yeah, because Pirates obviously won in 71. They won again in 79. And in between, they were always competing for the
Right.
National East Division title. And the Steelers really started making their way in 72. That was the first time they ever made the playoffs. And of course, the 70s, what happened with them the rest of the decade is history. Four Super Bowls in 6 years. So it was quite a time to be growing up in Pittsburgh with Pittsburgh sports. And the Penguins were always competitive.
Exactly. Now, when you were doing your initial writing, so on and so forth, I know you gained a passion for it over the years, so on and so forth. And one thing that we hooked up and worked with years ago was your first book on super fans. And I was reading through it last night again, refreshing my memory on it. It was nice memories reading about some of these super fans. Being from Connecticut and going to several Jets games over the years, I did get to meet Fireman Ed, who was
Oh, very cool.
a real character, to say the least.
Oh,
Real
yeah.
passionate for the Jets, so on and so forth. And I also, we both know Martin Jacobs, who writes for Gridiron Games Magazine, incredible fan and collector with regards to the San Francisco 49ers, still has a great passion for it at the same time. Let's give our audience some background on that book, why you wrote it, and give us some background on you being a Pittsburgh Steelers super fan.
Yeah, so story starts in 2001, and Visa, obviously the credit card company, was running a contest that I found on the internet. It was called the Visa Hall of Fans Award. And you write an essay on why you should represent your team in the Hall of Fame. So obviously I'm writing about the Steelers. And I had written in the essay, submitted it. It was like a contest. I had completely forgotten about it, Bob, until I got a call at the beginning of 1 week, and it was like in December or late November of 2001 from Ketchum Advertising in New York City. And they said, we just want to contact you. You're a potential winner in this Visa Hall of Fans Award. I was like, oh my gosh, I forgot I even wrote that essay. And they said, well, we'll let you know by the end of the week whether or not you're the winner. So on Friday, I get a call from them, and they said, yeah, you're the winner. Visa Hall of Fans Award. And what we're going to do is we're going to present an award to you at Heinz Field. So you're going to need to make your way down to Heinz Field this weekend. It was December 9th, the actual day of the game. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. So I was living in New York at the time, drove down to Pittsburgh and got to Heinz Field. They were waiting for me at a special gate. They gave me a special ticket. Walked me out to one of the representatives, walked me out to the 50-yard line. This is all before the game. And so Cy Holzer was the president of PNC at the time. We walked out to the 50-yard line, and they make this announcement. It's on the jumbotron. He hands me a plaque, and I'm like, now I'm having my 15 minutes. I go back to my seat, and I can hear some cheers and whatnot, and I'm waving my terrible towel, and this very large man stands up in front of me when I'm getting ready to take my seat, and he says, "Hey, Harv, I'm Charles Davis, the Pittsburgh Steelers. Played for them in 1974, won a Super Bowl with them that year, and showed me the Super Bowl ring." I was like, "Wow, very, very cool." So I had my picture taken with him, and I thought the rest was gonna—that was it. I thought it was over. Well, it turns out that when they first started giving out this award in 1999, all the fans that won the award, they were getting their plaques at the Hall of Fame in Canton.
Okay.
And so they decided that this was such a cool gathering of all these different fans that they would start doing it every year. So what happened was every time somebody won the award, and the award ran from 99 through 2004. So every year that the award was given out, they would contact these winners and say, hey, we have this organization called Professional Football's Ultimate Fan Association. They created that. And we want to invite you to come up here and take part in the Hall of Fame Day Parade and meet all these other fans. So I went up in 2002, and immediately when I got there, I see Big Dog from the Cleveland Browns, Barrow Man from the Denver Broncos, and Mikey Torbert, Boss Hoggett from the Redskins, and a bunch of all these other fans. And I was like, who am I to be hanging out with these guys? So I got to know all these people. I went up 2 straight years. And then 10 years later, I said to myself, you know what? It would be really cool to have a book profiling these fans because a lot of them are very, very famous. And so I contacted them all and asked them if they'd be willing to submit a profile to the book. And as you see in the book, a lot of them. In fact, the other day I was looking, there was 186 winners of this award from 1999 through 2004. And I've got, I think the count I had was 120 of them in the book. So almost got all of them. Now, some of them, what had happened was Barrow Man, in writing the book, in that time that I started the idea of the book, he had passed away. So I got in touch with his wife, Becky, and asked her, would you like to write a foreword for the book? Because we're going to dedicate the book to him, among others, several other fans that have passed away. And so she wrote the foreword for the book, and it got published, as you see. And now today, current time, I was writing another book, and I contacted a publisher, and he said, have you written any other books? And I told him about this one, and he said, man, you should rewrite this book, like a Where Are They Now? So I'm in the process of doing some research for that, and still there's more fans that were in that book alive at the time when the book came out that have now passed away. So, but I've got about 10 or 12 already that have contacted me that want to be profiled again. So that's where we're at with that book.
That's great. That's great. That's going to be an interesting book to reread, especially with all the updates on it at the same time. And sadly, because time marches on and people pass, their legacy with the team is just so strong. It's just so, it's just so identifiable. Fireman Ed from the New York Jets, classic example. I mean, I remember seeing that guy's years ago, and got an opportunity to say hi to him. A real friendly guy, real nice guy. And to me, all these super fans were just the nicest people you could meet. Such a
Oh, yeah.
passion for the team. It's just so cool to see, and so interesting to me, what how their fandom and how they actually are so dedicated to that team, win or lose, week in and week out. It's just incredible to watch and
Yeah,
incredible to see.
it's interesting you say that because when I got up there, you see in these stadiums where fans from different teams are fighting with each other and there's stupid lust slugfests and things like that. When we got up to Canton, everybody just got along, had such a good time. It was really cool to talk about, their teams and football in general. And since that time too, some of them have actually retired their so-called, what you call fanship. Big Dog does not go to the games anymore, and Big Nasty Keith Kunzick down in Tampa, he's retired his little shtick with his uniform. The Hoggetts don't exist anymore; they retired that whole thing. So, and it comes with age and time. I mean, the Hoggetts were around for 20, 25 years doing their thing, and of course, they all get older, and everything has to come to an end at some point.
Exactly. And my comments again, growing up in Connecticut and going to games in the old Schaefer Stadium in New England, the old seeing football games at Shea Stadium in New York, Yale Bowl, the old Yankee Stadium and then the old Meadowlands versus the new Meadowlands, so on and so forth. New York is a tough location to go to a game if you're a visiting fan. I'm trying to put it as eloquently as possible as I can. I've gone to a couple games where the Packers were playing. I was in my full Packer uniform. Man, did I hear it getting in and getting out of that place. And it's comical to me in a way because, again, we're fans. We're enjoying the game. It is what it is, and that's it. It's the spectacle of football. That's what it comes.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you when I was up there, I used to go to a couple of Jets games with Steelers and a couple of Giants games with Steelers. And there's a huge difference between their fan base. The Jets fans were obnoxious, really bad. Giants fans were gracious. Even as my team was losing and I'm exiting the stadium, they are all like, hey, good game. You know, sorry you guys lost, this kind of thing. So, a huge difference in the fans.
Exactly. And again, seeing I've been to several stadiums over there. I have not been to many, but I've been to Packers Bears in Chicago, and that was an incredible experience if there ever was one. We had gotten on-field passes for the game, so we're out there. So I got my Bart Starr jersey on and my hat, and I'm high-fiving fans as I'm walking out. And the security guy comes running at me. He says, "Get off the field now!" And he comes. I said, "Why? They're going to beat me up here or what?" That type of thing. And he says, "Just get out. You can't do that here." I was just laughing my head off because I thought it was just so funny to see.
Somewhat related to that story, I went to, you know, now living in Jacksonville, I've been to several Jacksonville Steelers games, and one of the last ones I went to, this Jaguar fan got into it with a Steelers fan and ended up pushing his wife. And of course, he wanted to fight back, and the security came running down and took the Jaguars fan and escorted him out of the stadium. And I clearly remember him saying, "Well, why are you asking escorting me out? This is my stadium, my home team." He says, "Dude, if we don't escort you out now, they're going to kill you." So he said, "I'm doing you a favor."
Exactly. And it's sad that it ends up that way. But again, it's just the nature of the game. And some of these guys have too much beer before the game or whatever, and they go in, and everything goes haywire, to say the least. So.
Well, it's proof that, and they call themselves PUFA, Professional Football Ultimate Fan Association. They were proof that it doesn't have to be that way. It was like a weekend party, you know, everybody's hanging out and having some beers, and we took part in the parade. And when I was up there as well, I used to go to the draft every year at Madison Square Garden. And you get in there, and that I always now it's out of control because they're going city to city. And I mean, I think they said there was 800,000 people in Pittsburgh this year for that draft. I don't know how these people down at the point in that area they held the draft that could even have fun at that draft. I mean, you're buried in a sea of people. Madison Square Garden limited the number of people that could go into the Felt Forum where they're having it. And so I remember the first year I went, I thought, hey, this will be cool. It's free. I'm going to go down and watch the draft. And I went down about 10 a.m. in the morning for the doors to open at 12. And there was a line a mile long to get in. And my friend at that time and I went up and got us up to the door. And the guy said, "Sorry, we're at our limit. Can't let you in." And we went back to his house. We watched the draft on television. But after that, we said, "Next year, we're getting here early." So the next year, I went at like 6 o'clock in the morning. And we easily got in. And it was a blast. It was so much fun because it was just a sea of different kinds of fans and everybody got along. It was no problems whatsoever.
That's cool. That's the good part about the game. That's definitely the good part about the game. And the good part about the super fans, they represent the team. They're passionate about the team. It's great to see. It's football. Football to me is where it should be. It's the same thing at a college game. You got the two rivalries playing, and each side represents the each side basically respects the other side as far as their loyalties, so on and so forth. So that's the one thing I've noticed down here in North Carolina. UNC, North Carolina State games, rivalries are just very, very passionate, and it is though very, very respectful between the teams. That's the cool thing about it, to say the least.
Well, with this new book, I had actually had this idea to rewrite a few years back, and I wrote to the president of this organization and said, because I was trying to get contact information for the people that were already in the book. And I asked them for permission to give me their contact information because they have it. And they refused. And they said, no, the reason we're refusing is because you're not going to include the fans that we've included since the award stopped, because the award stopped in 2004, but they kept naming fan of the year for themselves.
Okay.
So I let it go. This time around, I reached out to them and said, I'm now willing to include, your fans that you've elected. Anybody
Okay.
wants to volunteer the story, I'll put it in the book.
Yeah.
So
Oh, that's.
I'm very early in the stage here. I mean, I haven't really done much of anything yet except try to do some research to these people. But I think it's going to take at least the rest of the year because the manuscript, the publisher had asked me, do you have the manuscript, the original manuscript? And I said, no. I said, that was way long time ago. I have a different computer. He goes, well, what about your email address? Do you have that? Do you remember what email you used? I said, no, I don't even remember what that was because my email's changed.
Yeah.
So he said, well, we can research and we can get your manuscript for you. So they're going to be
Oh.
doing that. And then I'll be able to have the original manuscript and go from there and edit it, change it, whatever I
Okay.
need to do.
That's good. That's good. Now, besides that book, are you doing something else too, or?
Yeah, I came up with this idea that I thought would be a really good book. And it's going to be called 1970s Pittsburgh Steelers, A Decade to Remember.
Okay.
What I want to do is go year by year from 70 to 79 and just go year by year and in detail what took place because the Steelers still to this day are the only team to win four Super Bowls in 6 years.
Right.
I mean, the Patriots are tied with six Super Bowls, but they did that over a span of time.
Right.
Steelers won four of their six in a matter of just 6 years. In 1 year, when they were trying to go back and they were playing the Oakland Raiders in the championship game, Franco Harris and Rocky Blyer were injured. Neither of them could play. So Bradshaw had to rely on his passing game, and obviously Oakland knew that, and they weren't able to win that game. However, if had they done that, won that game, they may have won three in a row, which has never been done yet.
Right.
So, but it's going to be part of that, and Terry Hanratty, back up to Bradshaw for several years, who's been on my podcast, he's already volunteered to give me his experience of playing for the Steelers in the 70s.
Great.
Craig Colquitt, also on my show, he and I have already communicated. He said he's willing to give his story, and he is in touch with Cliff Stout, so Cliff Stout may be taking part, hopefully, I hope, as well.
That's great.
Yeah, and
That's
that's
great.
a long-term project. That won't be till sometime next year. It's going to take a lot of writing, so working on that.
Right. Well, it's good because if you can preserve the history while they're still alive, that's what it's all about. And that's a tough thing right now. We're in both you and I are similar in ages. A lot of the players from the 60s and 70s are passing rapidly. It's sad because again, we have to try to preserve their history as much as we can from their perspective, not from what we're reading or what we're interpreting. And that's a tough part of writing a book like that, to say the least.
Well, yeah, because a lot of these players from the 70s, there's a lot of them that have passed away.
Right.
So, unfortunately, a lot of them are no longer with us. Elsie Greenwood, Dwight White, a lot of that Steel Curtain, Joe Green is the only surviving member, I believe, so right now.
Right. So that's a tough write to say the least, and your time constraints between the real world and everything else really, plays into that at the same time. So that's important to try to get it together, which you are, and I'm sure you'll have good information from it one way or the other. Just an off-topic question, and I've been asking several people. I was asked this question several months ago. What do you think about the game today of football? What is are there areas that we need to improve? Are there areas that need to change? What's your perspective and thoughts about it? I mean, you followed the game all your life, just
Yeah.
I have, so.
I was just having this conversation with somebody else on a different podcast the other day. We were talking about the 70s. Actually, I did one with Mark Mortier, who's also in the Sports History Network with his own podcast. So he invited me on to have a discussion with he and one of his friends, who's also both of them are Dallas Cowboy diehards, about the rivalries of the Steelers and Cowboys in the 70s. And we talked a lot about what the game was like back then as opposed to what it's like today. Obviously, the game, even in the early 80s and going as far back as you can go, it was way more brutal than it is today. So today there's so many calls and penalty flags, and you hear defenders still talking about it, that they can't really do their job to their best of their ability because they're protecting the offense, they're protecting the receivers. You know, you used to be able to bump and run, and you can't do that anymore. You had guys that were allowed to hit at will. You know, now you're going to get roughing, or I mean, yeah, unsportsmanlike conduct if you hit a guy too hard. And that's not the way it used to be. So, I mean, I understand all the concerns about safety for players and everything else. They're trying to protect the players and this whole CTE thing that's going on. But you really never heard about that back then. It was guys that are crippled that are go out and playing games, you know. And today, you know, you hurt your pinky finger and you're out of the game. But Jack Youngblood played in the Super Bowl with a broken leg. I mean, it's crazy.
Really interesting to me, and what my comments were, I really believe football today is way overcoached. You have so many coaches on the staff. Everything has become, every position is a coach position now. So how do you coordinate 11 different coaches on offense and 11 different coaches on defense in some cases to coordinate putting it all together if one or two of those players miss their assignment or their, what the coaches are telling them to do? You end up with what? I don't know. So I really believe, you know, you go back to the, I look at the 60s, that's my favorite time for football. You only had three or four coaches on a team, and that was it. And look at the games you saw. In the 70s, it expanded a little. You had six, seven, eight in some cases. And look at the game you had. And then now, look at today, where you got your media guide consists of 10 pages of coaches and conditioning coaches and strength coaches and you name it. How are we playing the game? There's no spontaneity in the game in any way, shape, or form, as far as I'm concerned. It's very, very overcoached. It's over-specialized. And this is not a good flow to the game in any way, shape, or form. You know, that's the way I look at it. That's why I prefer watching high school football in a lot of cases and lower level division college football, because it's a little more spontaneous and it's a little less coached at the same time.
And I wrote an article recently on the new Steelers coaching staff. Mike McCarthy is from Pittsburgh, so he's on cloud nine. He's getting to coach his hometown team. But Mike Tomlin, he had a lot of coaches too. But I think McCarthy, I was looking down the list of coaches. Now, if you include every single kind of coach, even the ones that aren't on the field, I think he has like 24 to 26 coaches. Like, this is crazy. And some of them have crazy titles. I'm like, what the heck kind of title is that? What's he even doing? But
And the
you know
coach.
what, Bob? Football players know how to play football. I don't really think they need that much coaching. They know how to play the game. The problem is how they're refereeing the game. That's where the issue really is.
And in my opinion, you know, you're looking at a coaching box now, it's overcrowded. You got eight, nine guys up there. You should just have your two coordinators and an assistant, and that's it. Now you got everybody else. I don't know what everybody else is doing there other than getting on top of one another. And it's taken a lot of the fun of the game, but more importantly, the spontaneity of the game and how a player can adjust to seeing a different offense, seeing a different defense, you know, a real quarterback being able to call an audible online, seeing something that he didn't like, so on and so forth. It just amazes me. So to me, football today is much more entertainment based rather than you know, pure, you know, football strategy like you and I come from, you know, from that. You know, okay, I got to do this to offset this, therefore I'm gonna, you know, run this play. It's just amazing. But I've been asked that question three separate occasions over the past few months, and it really made me, think, okay, are people seeing what I'm seeing? And in some cases they are, with regards to the issues of, overcoaching, and in your and what you brought up, which I was going to say, the refereeing and how they're calling penalties today is just it's laughable, especially pass interference. I mean, some of the pass interferences, the guy doesn't even touch. The guy goes near him, and then they throw a flag on the guy. That doesn't really make a lot of sense one way or the other.
Well, you use the keyword entertainment. It is an entertainment business. I mean, back in our day, they weren't playing for entertainment. They were playing for the love of the game. They wanted to be on the field. They didn't have these crazy salaries that you have today. I mean, the millions and millions of dollars are flying around. It's just utterly ridiculous. And it's cheapened the game. These guys aren't playing as hard because they know they don't have to. They're getting paid. They've got guaranteed contracts. They got bonus money that's already given to them before they even start the season. And every sport is like that. I mean, if you take a look at baseball, it's not the same game anymore.
Not at
I
all.
mean, so many statistics. I was saying something about this before that I can't even keep up with the number of statistics they have. And now you got this instant replay on calls for baseball. I mean, they shouldn't have faith in the umpires that he's calling balls and strikes how they are. I mean, to
Well, to
have
me, that's just the way for them to replace the umpires eventually and be an automated call game, and that's it. And the pitching clock, to me, I just can't stand in any way, shape, or form. And I can't stand on the extra inning now. Now you got a guy on base. Come on. Just play the
Well,
game the way you should be,
and you know what else has disappeared is fundamentals. I mean, baseball used to be about stolen bases and stealing home and strategy and bunting when you need to bunt and trying to head a sacrifice lane when you really need it. You didn't have all these relief pitchers, special relief pitchers. I mean, it's crazy that a guy can't complete a game anymore because he's being yanked by the sixth inning or fifth inning. But I think I wrote an article that if you look back at the history of baseball, these pitching numbers that our records will never be broken because they won't allow it. Complete games, shutouts, games started, all these things. You can forget it. Those records are there for eternity.
And I just saw the Oakland Athletics had the most complete games back in the 70s. I forgot which season it was. They had something like 92 complete games on their pitching staff, which is unheard of. I mean, if you get one today, that's a lot type of thing. That's just,
Yeah, and you don't see many shutouts anymore, especially a complete game shutout. And I think I made a comment to somebody the other day. Cy Young is the all-time leader in wins. I think he's got 511. I think that's the number. Nobody's ever going to touch that. Nobody will even sniff that.
No.
It's not
And
going to happen.
the day of a 300 game winner is long gone too. It's going to be a 300 game winner, and that's a big season.
Well, think about this. Denny McClain, I think it was 69, maybe that was the year, or 68, won 30 games. 30 games. That's crazy. You can't hardly get 20 wins anymore.
I did a show in Wilmington, North Carolina, a few months ago, and he was set up as a signer. And I had a nice conversation with him, and it's pretty interesting. And he told a few good stories of games that he pitched in, and so on and so forth. But he's still hustling at his age, signing and trying to make a buck type of thing. Amazing story, to say the least. The Steelers got a new coach this year. A gentleman who I'm well aware of from the Packers,
No, that's
and
right.
I have a nice signed autograph of photo of him. I congratulate him when he got hired as a coach. And back then, in those days, they would send shareholders a picture of the new coach, short letter, so on and so forth. What are your thoughts on Mike McCarthy?
Well, when they Mike Tomlin decided to resign, and everybody, most I would say 90% of Stewart's fan base was happy about that. We haven't won a playoff game in 6 years, and we've got five straight first round exits. So most fans' sentiment is enough's enough. So they were happy to see him step down. And if he decided not to resign, he'd be back this year. It was his decision. The Rooneys would have had him back, but in replacing him, there was a lot of candidates. A lot of people were talking about let's get somebody young and innovative in here. And I was kind of on board with that at first. But then I thought about it. Listen, Mike McCarthy, he's an offensive guru. He's been around the block. He's been head coach for two teams. He's from Pittsburgh, which is a huge plus. And he did a lot of good hires. He knows what he's doing. So now I think he's going to be very successful. I mean, he's making a lot of right moves. He's bringing in a lot of good players. I know that Aaron Rodgers is coming back for another year, and people were apprehensive about that, especially since we have Will Howard and this kid from Penn State. I kind of thought it took away from their opportunity, either one of those young guys, to jump into the fire and find out if they're going to be our franchise quarterback. Because now Aaron Rodgers coming in, we already know he's going to be the starter. These two guys are going to sit there on the bench the whole year. They'll see very little playing time, and unless Aaron Rodgers gets hurt, they're not going to get on the field. And I kind of feel bad for Mason Rudolph, because with Rodgers coming back, he's out. They're not going to keep four quarterbacks, and he's going to be the odd man out. But with Mason, though, he was never going to be the answer. He's a decent quarterback, but he's not the guy that can lead this team to higher levels. No, not at all. But I think McCarthy's going to do really well.
I think I said this to a few people. Mike McCarthy was in a rough situation with the Cowboys, trying to deal with the Jerry Jones ownership, and his persona right there all the time on the field, so on and so forth. Remember that McCarthy came from the Packers, which is basically you don't have anybody over your shoulder except the GM. And he had a pretty good working relationship with them. He just couldn't win the big game type of thing. He did have a very good relationship with Rodgers at the time, so I think it's a good move on the part of the Steelers. He's a Pittsburgh guy. You can't you gotta have a you gotta have a homer. You gotta have somebody who has a passion for the city, passion for the team, for the franchise. And I know he does at the same time. I'm happy for him. I always liked Mike McCarthy. I thought he was a good guy. I was a good coach, and I liked him.
Well, I mean, the fact that they brought Rico Doughty in from Carolina after spending time, this guy's got like two straight 1,000-yard seasons. I mean, that's a huge signing. And then they added receivers too, to the core. The guy from Indianapolis, his name always slips my mind when I try to think of him. But he's going to be our number two. So he's got some good, talent on that team. So I really don't think, I know about people are already projecting that we might make the playoffs, but they'll probably lose in their first round. I don't go there. I think they have a potential to easily get to the playoffs and possibly even win at least one or more games.
I think that that division is a little different this season coming up. I think it's going to be very, very different one way or the other. And I think the Steelers got a good shot going deep in the playoffs, get there and then start to move ahead more than anything else. I think the Ravens are going to be a little influx for the simple reason Harbaugh is gone. I think the New York Giants might surprise people finally, but again, and hopefully he won't have a New York Giant curse on him like most former coaches have had over the past few years. It's rough to coach in New York. That's what they have to understand, and I think Harbaugh understands that, and he has adjusted his coaching and adjusted the way he's going to handle his players to a large degree that way too. So I think that.
He's an excellent coach. And Michael Pittman, by the way, is the other receiver I was trying to think of. I don't know why his name slipped my mind, but Michael Pittman and DK Metcalf, the one and two combination, that's going to be a lethal combination.
That's definitely going to be a big plus for them, and if they all stay healthy, and Rodgers still has some gas left in repertoire. He's not washed up. I was kind of surprised he would come back for 1 year, but I know he wants to end with a good note with McCarthy. I think that was an abrupt ending for him. As much as Matt LaFleur is a good coach, Matt has not won the big game yet. So, again, it's another Packer thing where how many years we're going to wait. Are we looking at a repeat of McCarthy again? And we're looking at a repeat of Mike Sherman again, so on and so forth. At least McCarthy won the Super Bowl once. You know what I mean? So that's the difference that we're seeing.
Well, Steelers Nation is just hungry, hungry, hungry for another Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
And but the thing about Rodgers going into last year, I didn't want them to sign him. I wanted to actually, what's his name from the Rams, Matthew Stafford, was on the trading block last year, and I learned that the Steelers were in the mix, and then they took themselves out of it. And I was like, "What are you guys crazy? Why would they not try to get him?" So I was a little apprehensive about bringing Rodgers in. But to tell you the truth, Bob, when the game started, and I've seen all the other quarterbacks before him playing after Roethlisberger, and immediately you could see his football smarts taking place. I mean, I was like, wow, this guy, he's a good field general. And the other surprising thing was he never had a game over 300 yards passing last year, but Steelers fans have never really been concerned themselves. They haven't concerned themselves with statistics. We don't care about stats. We want wins. And in the Houston game, when we finally lost, I mean, Houston had this incredible defensive line, and he never stood a chance. So,
And I think also Rodgers needed some vindication from his Jets experience because that was a very, very rough 2 years for him. That really didn't make a lot of sense career-wise. But he did what he did. He still wanted to play. You know, it's a tough drug to walk away from when you walk out on a field and 80,000 people are screaming your name. You know, get used to that. You know, 8 Sundays a year type of thing. So it's rough to walk away from the game.
Well,
And you
he
know,
says this is his last year,
I'm in
no
a
matter
way
what.
glad he finally sees, okay, this is the ending. You know, I gotta put it out. So I can silence my critics, but at the same time show to myself and prove to myself I can still do it. And I always liked Rodgers with the Packers. I thought he was a great quarterback. I understood his frustration when Jordan Love came around. It's the same frustration Brett Favre had. Is what it is. At some point, your team's got to say, okay, you know, you had a great career. That's it, you know.
Well, a bit of irony is that so Rodgers' last Super Bowl was against the Steelers, and it was against Mike McCarthy. Now the both of them are on the team going the other way. So it's kind of odd, but.
It's interesting. The two star quarterbacks of the Packers both end up on the Jets, and you know, Favre ends up with the Vikings of all teams, and then at least Rodgers went to the Steelers with a, to me, a much better situation with Mike McCarthy. So it's
Yeah, I think the bottom line for me is just listen, there can be no excuses this year. They've got talent across the board. So for them not to make the playoffs, it would be a lost season if they don't make the playoffs.
Exactly. Couple other points, and we're gonna wrap up our show. Tell us a little about the Total Sports Recall. What you do there.
Yeah, so when I first started Total Sports Recall podcast, I was watching everybody else doing interviews of athletes and authors and things like that, and I thought, well, maybe that's what I should be doing. So I was focusing on just trying to get interviews. So being from Pittsburgh, I got several Pittsburgh athletes as guests on the show. One of them was my high school classmate. His name is Steve Fidel, and he was a year ahead of me, but he went on to play for University of Pittsburgh, did really well. Got signed as an undrafted free agent with the Steelers, and unfortunately, because of an injury, his career was cut short. But he was a massive linebacker, very, very good. And then I had known that Terry Hanratty had a podcast out there, and I was listening to his podcast, and I found out who his producer was, and I wrote him an email and I said, "Listen, I'm from Pittsburgh. I watched Terry play. Would he be interested in being on my show?" And I get a call about a week later, and it's Terry Hanratty calling me saying, "Hey, Harv, I'd love to be on your show. You know, what do I need to do?" And he came on board. It was really a fun conversation, him telling old war stories. He had some really funny Jack Lambert stories. And then Craig Colquitt, I had established a relationship with him years ago, and got back in touch with him, and he came on board, and he was a lot of fun to have on the show. And of course, he won the Super Bowl, and he's got two sons that punted as well. So there's a family of punters. So then after a while, couldn't find people to interview. I was struggling with that. So I went on a sabbatical. And about a year later, I reached out to Arnie Chapman, the owner of Sports History Network, and said, "Listen, can I come back?" And he said, "Of course." So I said, "Well, this time around, I'm only going to do sports history. So all my topics from here on out will be some kind of sports history topic. I just did one yesterday. It's going to be a four-part series. I'm looking back at the overall number one pick in each of the major league, major sports drafts. So I started with baseball. So there started in 1985 or 1985, I think it was, something like that. I'm not, I can't remember the first year, but I did the first 20 years of the baseball's draft and who was number one and how they did. And I'm going to do football next and then basketball and then hockey. So the next four episodes are already taken. But this one I did yesterday, Darryl Strawberry was the overall number one. Everybody knows how well he did. And Bob Horner was a good player for the Atlanta Braves. Harold Baines was the number one pick, and he's in the Hall of Fame. So it was interesting doing that research. And so, yeah, so it's going to be all sports history product topics only. And of course, my Total Sports Recall, my little catch line is covering sports from a different angle with a Pittsburgh twist. So there will be some Pittsburgh stories now and then in there. And that's the podcast.
That's great. That's great. I look forward to listening to it. I'm sure our listeners are going to look forward to hearing you and all the other members of Sports History Network. It's a very, very strong network as far as
It
a
is.
wide variety of all the sports, including boxing, soccer, so on and so forth. So there's a lot covered there. It's an exciting area. I know I've been off for a couple of months just for a variety of reasons. We were traveling and I just had a bunch of other commitments to try to finish off. So I'll be back, getting playing caught up as far as our podcasts are concerned. I got to wait for Joe's soccer vacation to end too. So
Yeah.
I'm
Well, that's the one last thing about my podcast is that I'm not limited to just football, the major sports. As growing up, I was a huge boxing fan. So occasionally get some boxing stories on there. And I actually even have been to professional golf tournaments. So you might hear some golf sometimes. Not as much a hockey fan, but I did follow the Penguins and I still do. But I don't limit myself to just any one particular sport. I like to talk about all sports.
Right. Well, I do like all sports, but we concentrate just on football. That's my specialty. It's always been, and I like football. I mean, I can't deny it in any way. I like the game. I like the history of the game. I like the memorabilia of the game. I think it's a fascinating history. I always said it's a chess match on the 100-yard line between 22 moving pieces. That's what it comes down to. And I like the coaches. I like all that kind of stuff. And it's very interesting to me, and it's been my passion pretty much all my life, and my collection my entire life at the same time. And
Well, I don't think we should ever let go of sports history because these sports history laid the groundwork for all these sports.
right.
And if it wasn't for these founding fathers and the guys that played the game early, it wouldn't be what it is today. There's no
Exactly.
question about it. I mean, I actually went to a fundraiser. One thing I do have one last note for you, Bob, is that one thing that kind of rubs me the wrong way is how the NFL fails to take care of their veterans. Now, I went to a fundraiser years ago and some players came down, former players, and they were talking to me about how they have friends that are crippled,
Right.
injured from football, and they get nothing.
Right.
So
Right.
the NFL pension plan is terrible. They've
Right.
got so much money, they should be taking care of these guys. It is kind of sad.
Right. And that's Mike Ditka's Gridiron Greats Association, where he's trying to help as many guys as he can through his fundraising, so on and so forth. And that's a horrible statement on a multi-billion-dollar corporation like the NFL, who still has antitrust exemptions on top of it. It really bothers me too. And I know we've been involved with several fundraising events and several fundraisers for players, and we're not broadcasting it in any way, shape, or form. But that's not right. That really is not right.
No.
And
And there might be younger fans that take this the wrong way, but I'm telling you right now that the guys that played back in history, these guys that are playing today will never be as great as those guys were.
right.
No chance.
I agree. I agree 100%. And you can be mad about it, but that's the reality of the situation.
That's right. Because they
But
played for the love of the game. They're not playing for
exactly.
money, so their heart was in it. They played hard.
All right. And our hearts are in it too. We're trying to preserve the game, try to preserve the history of the game, because once history's lost, it's lost. I mean,
Right.
that's the bad part about it. All right. Any final thoughts, Harv? Where can folks reach you again?
Yeah, so by email, it'll be totalsportsrecall@gmail.com. They can go to, like you already mentioned, the different networks you can find my podcast at, and they're out there. I don't know that the older ones with like handwriting that might be up there still. I'm not sure, but they can find my current podcast there. And then, of course, Abstract Sports every once in a while, I write for them. Of course, your magazine, your great magazine. And
Thank
as
you.
we talked the other day, I'm going to be the next article for your next issue. Came up with this uncanny idea that they have Mr. Irrelevant at the end of every draft, the last guy drafted it. And of course, we already know about the San Francisco quarterback that did so well with that. But I'm going to go back to the first 10 years of the draft, which started in 1936, and see who was the last person drafted in each of the first 10 years and see how well they did. That'll be the next article.
It'll be very interesting. I'm looking forward to it. I did a little quick review on that. It should be interesting. It's going to be a good article. I appreciate it.
Great. Oh,
Well,
of
Art, we're out
course.
of time. Thank you for being on. I appreciate it. We'll be in touch. We're hopefully going to have a couple more podcasts for June over the next few weeks. So please listen and check it out. And if you're not subscribed to Gridiron Grace Magazine, what are you waiting for? GridironGraceMagazine.com. Check out all our subscription information. Until then,
Bob,
thanks for listening.
yep.
Thanks
Thanks
for
for
being
having me, Bob.
here. And we'll
Been
be
a
back.
pleasure.
Take care.
Hi, this is Joe Ziemba, and I'm the host of the podcast When Football Was Football here on the Sports History Network. This podcast is based on stories, events, and characters from my book called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL, which was written shortly after the Cardinals won their last championship in 1947, or so it seems. The reason for this message is twofold. First, to share the great news that the second edition of the book has just been released by McFarland Publishers, and all Sports History Network listeners can now enter a special Sports History Network contest for the opportunity to win one of two free copies of When Football Was Football. We'll be happy to include a personal inscription in each winner's book and then send it out to you with our best wishes. The new book contains about 80 more pages than the original, almost all new archival photos, additions within all chapters based on new research, and an update on the players, coaches, and administrators mentioned in the book. It's everything you ever wanted to know about the early Cardinals, as well as the NFL itself. To enter this free giveaway, go to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. Thank you.